Thank you. And if you did not get a handout, please wave down, and Brian here will help you get one. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm not sure which, I'm going to stand down here and teach on the floor because I'm going to use this overhead projector. So if you would like to move forward in that you don't hear or see as well, you're welcome to move forward right now. We've still got some nice seats up here. If you're planning on escaping because it might be too boring, then you should stay in the back. Usually people on the side in the back. That's why. Planning to get out. Melissa knows she's not leaving until the end. That's why she's stuck at plenty. Can you hear me okay?
No. No, not.
I don't think it's on. Now, all right, there's also no clip on this thing, so we're jury-rigging the whole deal. All right, reaching the reluctant writer, I am assuming that you are here at this talk, either because you have, or possibly you are yourself, or maybe both, a reluctant writer. And it is interesting to note that there seems to be a very wide spectrum of aptitude when it comes to writing, doesn't it? Certainly, if you have ever been in a classroom, you'll see a very broad range. Even in the home, if you've got more than about two kids, you've got children, you know, some way over here, you know, the 18-pagers who can whip out a spiral notebook and start a story and go on and on and on, page after page, doing in their spare time. You read the thing, it goes on and on and on, page after page. You're not quite sure how to help her, but whoo, can she put words on paper? On the other end of the spectrum, you have a child, usually a boy, not always, but often a boy, who would rather scrub all the toilets in the building twice than have to put one entire paragraph on paper. It is so overwhelming. It is so tedious. It is so pain-evoking. And you don't really know how to help them. One of our problems as teachers and parents is that when we finally find something that works to help one child, it may not help the other, because the approach is just not connecting with the child. So while I could talk about developing talented writers into more talented writers, we're not here to talk about that. We're talking about the reluctant writer. So what I'm going to share with you is a very simple idea. It may be new to you, but it's actually a very old idea in reality. Something which you can learn here in 1 hour with me, and you can go home and do this Monday morning with a writer, and I would virtually guarantee that you will see a very significant change in attitude. What we do, essentially, is in our system, what I'm going to teach you, is we remove the problem of what to write about, because that very often is the defining problem, isn't it? You know, if I meet a child who doesn't like to write, and I say, "Why do you not like writing?" You know, once they get past, "Well, it's just hard. I don't like it." Well, what's the real problem here? Very often, 8 times out of 10 is, I don't know what to write. I can't think of anything. Has anyone had that experience? Blank brain, blank paper. And the kid's like, "I just can't think of anything." And of course, you read all these books, you buy curriculum, and it tries to cheerlead you into thinking of something. And when you finally figure out something you write about, you're so exhausted, you've got no time or energy to actually do that well, right? So what we do is we remove the problem of what to write about and say, "Okay, child, in order to learn to write, you do not have to, initially, you do not have to think of what to write. We will give you a little Aesop fable, a bit of interesting information about an animal or a person or a place, something you may need or want to know about anyway. Even a parable from the Bible. Anything will work as long as it is at or below the reading level of the student." And we say, "Okay, now we're going to teach you this little system where you read a sentence, take a few keywords from that sentence, put them in a little outline here. Read the next sentence, take a few keywords, read the next one, take a few keywords, remove the original, and then reconstruct, at first verbally and then on paper, reconstruct this little story or bit of information. Little Aesop fable, little bit of interesting animal, people, place. And this is almost magical in how well it works to remove the problem of I can't think of anything to write about. You don't have to. You can retell this. You know, I have a great empathy for children, especially for boys who don't like writing, because I did not like writing at all as a child. And I did okay with the reports, because reports all you had to do was copy from the encyclopedia and change a few words here and there. But I remember the teacher, you know, fourth grade, fifth grade, she would say, okay, children, today we're going to write stories. You get to make it up. And I remember the terror of that, sitting there thinking, I can't think of anything. I can't come up with anything. I can never think of anything. You know, and I get, once upon a time there was you know, and by the time I had got that, you know, inevitably I was sitting next to some 18-pager who was, you know, 4 pages into her next novel. And I remember looking at kids like that thinking, how can they do that? I can't just make up stuff. And now that I'm old, I understand entirely. Nobody makes anything. No one creates something from nothing. Everybody has to have something to work with, right? Nobody can produce something from nothing. Only God does that. The rest of us are kind of stuck with what we've got. And so now I understand that any idea is really the combination and permutation of other existing ideas that you have in your mind. And when you make something, you don't really produce it from nothing. You combine things in a new way. Like make a cake. You don't make a cake. You assemble the ingredients. You come out with a cake, but you don't produce this thing from nothing. Do you see? So I have a lot of empathy for children. And I think back and I think, you know, if my teachers in fourth or fifth grade had said to me, hey, Andy, you don't have to make up a story if you can't. You can, you know, retell an existing story. Tell a story that you read or that you read at home or that we read in school. You could retell an existing story. I could have done that. And it would have been an entirely different universe. So when I discovered this system as an adult, I got very excited because I realized you don't have to think of something in order to learn to write. And now I see the truth of it. If you learn to write, you actually learn how to think better in the process. So we'll start with this system, and I'm going to teach it to you. But as I mentioned, it isn't actually a new idea, maybe new to you, if you went to school in the circumstances that I did, where, you know, writing was about it all comes from your brain and you have to make it all up. And if you steal an idea from somewhere, that's plagiarism or cheating. It's not at all new. It actually predates that whole system and goes all the way back to ancient times. If you're familiar with the progymnasmata, the rhetoric exercises used in pre-Christian Greece even, the very first exercise was to retell a fable. The second exercise was take a short story and make it longer. And the third exercise was take a long story and make it shorter. And those were the first three exercises in developing the rhetoric skills of the ancients. I had an interesting experience. My daughter, Genevieve, I put her in ninth grade as an experiment. It was a private Christian school in Idaho. She burst into my office one day. She goes, Dad, have you read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography? And I said, well, yes, but I don't remember anything, so don't ask me any hard questions. She said, no, Daddy, look right here, because this is how you taught me to write. And I read it, and I was much amazed with it, actually. I'll share a little bit with you. If you can't see this, you should have sat up closer. But I'll just read it to you if you can't see it. When my father happened to find my papers, he took occasion to talk to me about the manner of my writing, observed that although I had the advantage of my antagonist in correct spelling and pointing, which I owed to the printing house, I fell far short in elegance of expression, in method, and in perspicuity, of which he convinced me by several instances. I saw the justice of his remarks and thence grew more attentive to the manner in writing and determined to endeavor at improvement. Wouldn't it be great if all kids were just like that? About this time, I met with an odd volume of The Spectator. It was the third. I had never before seen any of them. I bought it, read it over and over, and was much delighted with it. I thought the writing excellent and wished, if possible, to imitate it. With that view, I took some of the papers and, making short hints of the sentiment in each sentence, laid them by a few days, and then, without looking at the book, tried to complete the papers again by expressing each hinted sentiment at length, as fully as it had been expressed before, in any suitable words that should come to hand. Now, I think that is exactly what I described to you, in a way. He had a source text. He took a few keywords from each sentence, put the original away, and then tried to recreate those ideas. Somehow, Franklin intuited, he knew, somehow, that if he's going to improve his writing, he needed something to practice on, something to imitate, if you will. And this is true in anything. If you just keep doing what you can do, and you only do what you can do, you will only be able to do what you can do because you aren't trying to do anything you can't do. Did you follow that? So you basically just cap out your level. It's like if you just sit down at a piano and kind of fool around all day every day for 7 years. Will you learn to play the piano? Yes. Will you learn to play it well? Probably not, right? So we see in music, art, sports, this need for imitation, right? Because if you've got something better than you, then you can see what it is and try to do it. Then you're trying to do something you can't do all on your own, thereby becoming better than you previously were. So Franklin somehow intuited this. Then I compared my Spectator with the original, discovered some of my faults, and corrected them. But I found I wanted a stock of words or a readiness in recollecting and using them, which I thought I should have acquired before that time, since the continual occasion for words of the same import but of different length to suit the measure of different sound for the rhyme would have laid me under a constant necessity of searching for variety and also have tended to fix that variety in my mind and make me master of it. Now, I think he wrote this before we had identified the problem of the run-on sentence. This is kind of hard to wade through, but if you read it a few times, you get what he's essentially saying is, when I started to write out those ideas, I realized that I didn't have the vocabulary and the variety of expression to do justice to those ideas. Actually, what I think he was saying is, I sure could use a thesaurus of the English language, which hadn't been invented at that time. And it is an interesting little trivia. Do you know those little electronic dictionary, speller, thesaurus things? There's one company that dominates. What's that company? The Franklin Company. The Franklin Speller. And so they produce these little electronic ones. And why is it called the Franklin Company? Because of that paragraph in this book. A readiness in recollecting and using the words. And I would recommend for you, especially if you have boys, but for most reluctant writers, these little electronic dictionary things, are thesaurus things, are tremendous. I have had parents come back to me a year later and say, thank you so much for mentioning that. I bought one, and my son, it opened up the whole universe of words for him. Because if you're able to give him ready access to the words, then it's a lot more fun, especially when you don't know how to spell things. By the way, if you'd ever like to get a child to never use any interesting words in his writing, this is how you do it. He says, Mom, how do you spell tyrannical? And you say, look it up. Have you ever watched a 10-year-old boy use a dictionary? It's hilarious. He's like, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. Okay, T, got it. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. Right? It's gonna take him, Tim. Plus, how in the world would you ever find tyrannical in the dictionary if you didn't know how to spell it first, right? So I recommend you be as human dictionary. But also, if you get these little devices, it has thesaurus, and so you can have, you know, you can type in mean and find probably tyrannical. And if you get the right kind, it has a spell checker, a dictionary, a thesaurus, and a hangman game all built into one. So I highly recommend those things. All right, moving on. I also sometimes jumbled my collections of hints into confusion, and after some weeks endeavored to reduce them into the best order before I began to form the full sentences and complete the paper. Now, that's weird. He had his notes, right? He intentionally mixed them up and then tried to reorganize them. Why would anyone do that? Well, the next sentence answers it. This was to teach me method in the arrangement of thoughts. Isn't that a great idea? Let's have method in the arrangement of our thoughts. I would love to do that, have better arrangement in the method of my thought. And you could, if you had young children, you could get that idea and you could take a story, put it on sentence strips, right? Mix them up, And then talk about what should go first and why, and what should go next and why, and what would be a logical sequence to put these, to put this in order before you could even write on paper. You could practice that activity. And really what he was doing is preparing himself to do harder research, where you have several different sources of information, and you go and you collect notes from several different sources, and then you have to put them, you know, fused together in some kind of logical sequence. All right, now from here it gets very important for you. This, by comparing my work afterwards with the original, I discovered many faults and amended them. But I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that in certain particulars of small import, I had been lucky enough to improve the method or the language, and this encouraged me to think I might possibly in time come to be a tolerable English writer, of which I was extremely ambitious. Now, that is by far the most important thing on this page, because it unlocks for us the secret of motivation. Read it again. I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that in certain particulars of small import, I had been lucky enough to improve the method or the language, and this encouraged me. I find this to be 100% consistently true with children. I often get kids come into my writing classes, and I think they're coming in at knife point. Because, you know, they got the raccoon eyes, you know they've been crying in the car. This idea of a two-hour writing class is as close to, you know, actual hell as they will ever get. You know, mom's behind them, you're going in there. They sit down. Those same kids, right, 2 hours later, they may walk out of that classroom with a little version of the hare and the tortoise or something, almost word for word, the same as the one I put up on the screen, but they did that cool little thing. They changed it a little bit, you know, put in the L-Y word that they liked, or they changed the judge from an owl to a cheetah so no one would be caught cheetahing. You know, and they thought of some cute little thing to change. It's still the everybody's hare and the tortoise, but that encouraged, and they'll say stuff like, that was fun. Can I do that again? Is he coming back? The change is in that they improved something a little bit, you see? Because when you say, be unique, be original, make it all up, be stunningly brilliant, that has no integrity, okay? It really doesn't. But when you say, take something and make it a little better, that has integrity because that's what life is about. Very few of us will go to our deathbed having become a great creative genius. Very few of us are going to be like a Nikola Tesla or a C.S. Lewis or a Florence Nightingale. Most of us are going to go to our deathbed having gained our satisfaction by making our little corner of the world better in some small way. And that has integrity. And so when you give children an opportunity to do that, they respond very positively. And of course, the beautiful irony of it is Franklin himself became what? A great creative genius. But he knew somehow he needed to begin with this process of imitation. So what I want to show you here is exactly how to do this Monday morning with any child. Now, I pretty much teach the same thing to children, whether they're in second grade or graduate school. What makes good writing in second grade is the same thing that makes good writing in seventh grade or 12th grade or whatever. What differs is three things. Number one, the speed at which you introduce new ideas. Number two, the reading level of the source material that you use. And number three, the way you talk to kids. But the ideas, the way to do stuff, I teach to everybody pretty much the same way. So the most important thing for you to remember right now is that you choose a source text which is at or preferably below the reading level of your student. So you want to choose something which is at or below the reading level. Now we're going to use an Aesop fable today. I have discovered that you can pretty much use Aesop fables with anybody, whether they're 7 years old or 17 years old. Nobody objects to Aesop fables. They have the advantage of being short, and short is good, especially when you have reluctant writers, right? So if it's short, you get done, and doing more frequent, shorter assignments is actually better for everybody. What do children enjoy the most about schoolwork? Being finished. So if you do more frequent, shorter things, you get to be finished more often. So life is better. Whereas if you do one long thing and it takes you all week, then that's not as fun. Sometimes even not fun or unfun. I'm going to use an Aesop fable, but you don't have to limit yourself to Aesop fables. By the way, just in case you want a nice free source of easy-to-use Aesop fables, just go to aesopfables.com, and there's about 180 of them, and then you can, you know, print them out in any font size on a piece of paper. Very easy to get. But of course, libraries, and you probably all have some Aesop fables at home. But you don't have to limit to that. You can use, as I mentioned, information about something you need to learn or maybe are interested anyway, interesting animal, person, place. Does anyone have a boy reluctant writer in this room? I'm going to give you a freebie here. Go and get a little bit of information on the slime eel. It's also called the hagfish. Either one will get you there. And just try to find a couple paragraphs about the slime eel or the hagfish, because this is really a fascinating creature. Now, when it is attacked, okay, when it is threatened, it kind of vomits out from its skin. It just exudes a great blob of slime, which chemically reacts with the seawater, and then it actually surrounds and suffocates the enemy. Okay, now this is lovely. But it gets even more interesting, because the slime eel, in order to get out of its own slime, has to have a method there, or else it dies too. So it ties itself in a knot, and it scooches the slime off its tail. Right? But it gets even better. When the slime eel eats a hagfish, it doesn't actually have teeth, but it kind of goes and it kind of latches on, much like a leech, to its prey. And then it has this little rasp-like tongue, which kind of digs a hole in its prey, and it eats it alive from the inside out. Now, all the ladies are like, oh. But all the men are like, whoa, that's pretty cool. And I will tell you, any boy worth his salt would far prefer to write a little one-paragraph report about the slime eel than something really important like Dolly Madison and the flag. I mean, what is there to say? She made it, so what? But the slime eel, you can get into that with your imagination, you see? So find creatures which are particularly disgusting, repulsive, violent, dangerous, look ridiculous, or hopefully all of those in one creature, like the slime eel, and then you will see almost an immediate improvement in attitude from some of those boys. But we're going to go ahead and do an Aesop fable. And you do have this on your paper, so if you cannot see this and you don't want to take one of these nice seats up front here, you can stay in the back and just listen but follow along on your paper. And I'm going to show you essentially how I would teach children to do this keyword outline business. So first, I recommend you get something, just read it through once to get a sense of it so you kind of have a feeling of the whole. So the fox and the goat. By an unlucky chance, a fox fell into a deep well from which he could not escape. A goat passed by and asked the fox what he was doing down there. "Oh, have you not heard," said the fox, "there is going to be a great drought, so I came down here in order to be sure to have water by me. Why don't you come down too?" The goat thought this a good idea and jumped into the well. But the fox immediately sprang onto her back and by putting his foot under long horns managed to hop up to the edge of the well. "Goodbye, friend," said the fox. "Remember, be careful of the advice of one who is in trouble." Okay, a timeless tale. It's going on right now in the stock market, right? Who wants to sell you all those cheap stocks? The people trying to dump it on the other side because they know that thing's going downhill fast, you see? Same story. All right. So, again, now, we have a little spot on your outline, so you can put the title in, Fox and Goat. Those would be like freebies. So you won't forget who you're writing about. And then we're going to choose a maximum of three words from each sentence. So we go back to the first one and say, by an unlucky chance, a fox fell into a deep well from which he could not escape. All right, keywords, what do you like? All right, we could write fox, but we just put fox. We're not going to forget that part. Okay, fell. Unlucky. And escape. All right, so an unlucky fox fell into a well and could not escape. And we might like to use a little symbol to remind us that he could not escape. What's the symbol for could not or do not? Yeah, your little no smoking thing. All right, so there we go. Okay, hopefully that will remind us of the basic idea of that sentence. Okay, a goat passed by and asked the fox what he was doing down there. All right, keywords, what do you like? All right, passed, and someone said asked, and what are you doing? All right, so that should probably work. And if we thought we were going to forget who passed by, we could just put a little G for the goat, and that would be a freebie. But the goat passed by and asked, what in the world are you doing in that hole? Okay, so we choose three words. Oh, have you not heard, said the fox. There's going to be a great drought, so I came down here in order to be sure to have water by me. Now, that's kind of a long sentence, but we're still only going to choose three, so you have to choose carefully. What do you like? All right, there's going to be a great drought. Heard. And down. Actually, you can use the arrow for down. Water, okay. So, the fox said, have you not heard about the drought? I came down to have plenty of water. Now, that is a long sentence, but we still limit to three. And I would recommend that you do this, have a limit. Now, I will, with high school age kids, when I'm first teaching this method, I'll go with four words, only because the reading level's higher and the sentence is a little bit longer. Four words. I never do start with more than four. It really doesn't matter whether you start with three or four as a maximum. What matters is that you stick to it. Because if someone says, well, this is a longer sentence, couldn't I please have five? And then someone else over here says, well, you know, if he could have five, I'm sure I could have six. It wouldn't really matter. Six, seven, what's the difference? Pretty soon, what would be happening? Yeah, you'd be copying huge chunks or whole sentences, and the essence of keywordness would be lost. So I strongly recommend you stick with a strict limit. Symbols and abbreviations can be free. Separate the words with commas, and that's how this approach works best. The other thing I might point out is that for young children or children who really struggle with reading and writing, it's nice if they can have a paper that they can write on. You can use a book, but if you can't write in the book, it's not quite as nice. So I'd make a photocopy or try to print it out. Because what happens is children, if you ask them to choose the key words, they'll very often give you the last thing first. So if you say, you know, have you not heard there's going to be a drought, so I came down here to be sure and have water by me. What's the most important word? They might say water because it was the last one they heard. That's because the human memory works most efficiently in recent to distant. Did you know this? So if you read something, you want to remember what you read, try to remember the last thing you read first and work backward through the chapter. You'll recall more details than if you try to go to the beginning and work forwards through it. Also, the other thing is children can get lost in text. Have you ever noticed that? I remember that as a child. You'd be reading, something would happen, you'd look away, and you look back at your book and go, ah! I lost my place. Where am I? Ah! I hated that because you had to read the whole page again to figure out where you were. And that was just so tedious. So if you're underlining, you can mark in any order. Then you can copy them in the order that they come chronologically there. And that'll help reconstruct the language. And then you go back to your most recent underline. You see where you were. So having a piece you can underline. With older kids, once they've done it for a while, they can kind of drop that idea. It's not necessary. It's just helpful in the beginning. Okay, next sentence. Why don't you come down too? All right. Come. Yeah, and you may not even need three words. Let's say you just say, all I need is come and two, and just use two words. That's fine. There's no rule that says you have to choose three. You can use one, two, or three. All right. The goat thought this a good idea, jumped down into the well. Keywords? All right, goat. Good idea. And jumped or down. Yeah, either one. And there's no absolute right way to do this. There's, some words tend to work better than others. What I've discovered is that children actually catch on to this process faster than most adults because they're a little more flexible in their thinking there. The fox immediately sprang onto her back and by putting his foot on her long horns managed to hop up to the edge of the well. Yeah, probably he's doing a lot of jumping here. You know he's jumping. Maybe we go with the back, right? All right, back. And then on to the horns. And then finally to the edge. All right. Really can't have been that deep of a well. All right. Goodbye, friend, said the fox. Remember, be careful of the advice of one who is in trouble. Now, why don't you try this one yourself? I think you've got the hang of it here. So go ahead and you choose from that last sentence, from there to there, you choose three words and put that in your keyword outline. Goodbye, friend, said the fox. Remember, be careful of the advice of one who is in trouble. Okay, just go ahead. You choose and put it in. We'll see what you get. What'd you go with, Diane?
Careful, advice, and trouble.
Careful, advice, trouble. Good. Anyone choose exactly those same three? Excellent. Someone choose something different. What'd you go with? Yeah.
Remember, advice, trouble.
Remember, advice, trouble. That should work pretty well. Anyone get something other than that? Yep. What'd you go with?
Remember, careful advice.
Okay. All of those should work. So there's no real one right way to do this. And what you will discover is that in doing it, you start to get the hang of it and look for the words that are going to help you lock the meaning. Okay? So, again, you can do this with a child of any age as long as they are old enough to read somewhat independently and copy words. You can do this. And I've done this with 17-year-olds as well. So you can teach it to anybody. And then, of course, you've got your outline. And now the next step in this process is to test the outline. Now, very important, this is not a test of the child. We're not trying to test the kid and see if he remembers it or not. It's not a test of the memory. We're trying to test the outline and see if it works. So we kind of cover up or remove the original. Okay? And then we say, all right, we wrote, unlucky, fell, not escape. Why did we write that? What was the basic idea? Who could make a sentence out of that? Let's pick on this row right here because you look nice. What's your name?
Brittany,
could you start us out and just make a sentence out of something about fox, unlucky, fell, and escape?
An unlucky fox was walking down the road and fell into a well which could not escape.
An unlucky fox was walking down the road and fell into a well from which he could not escape from. Yeah, it's okay. You can do it. Because Winston Churchill said this. That rule about never end a sentence with a preposition. Churchill said, this is the sort of pedantry up with which I will not put. So it's okay. But now, was hers exactly like the original?
No.
Do I care? No. Did she say it in a complete sentence?
Yes.
Do I care?
Yes.
I want to be sure that the student says a complete sentence. And if I get a student for some learning issue or second language, more likely problem, who cannot make a complete sentence, I will go so far as to dictate one and make them repeat back, and dictate the next and repeat back, and dictate and repeat back, and model it very, very tightly till they start to get the hang of it. I have found that most all native speakers, especially children, get the hang of this very fast. So it's not a hard thing at all. All right, Phil, is it? Can you help us there? You've had a minute to plan what you're going to say here. G passed, asked doing.
A goat passed along and asked the fox, what are you doing in there?
A goat passed along and asked the fox, what are you doing in there? Good, perfect. Next one. The fox replied, oh, you haven't heard. There's a drought coming, and I came down here to be near the water. Excellent. All right, next. You got the easy one there.
Why don't you come too?
Why don't you come too? All right, proceeding down the row there. G, good idea, jumped. The goat thought this was a good idea, so he jumped in as well. You get the tricky one now. The fox jumped onto the goat's back, and then onto his horns, and then onto the edge of the well. Very nice. And you can finish this up there, but you'll have to look at your own paper.
The fox said goodbye, my friend. You should be wary of taking the advice of someone.
The fox said goodbye, my friend. You should be wary of taking the advice of someone in trouble. Excellent. All right. Very nice. Now, nobody did it. I was kind of hoping, but we're in Massachusetts, which I know is the most educated state of the country. So it didn't happen. It would have certainly happened in Arkansas, where someone would look and say, I can't remember why I wrote this word. Is right? Now, if someone had looked at that and said, I can't remember why I wrote the word, is it okay to go and read the original again? Yes, absolutely. In fact, some children may benefit from reading the original 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times. There's no rule that says you can't go back and read it again. So you go back, read, oh, that's why I wrote that. You could even change the outline if you wanted to and say, well, that wasn't a very good word to choose. I should choose this different one. Change the outline, right? And then go back, cover it up again, and proceed on trying to reconstruct the story or the information. So it's completely all right to go back and look again at the original. I did have, though, one class. I told them they could do this. I had this one little boy. He had written 3 words and crossed out all 3 and written 3 more words on each line. And I looked at him the first couple lines. I thought, oh, he's been very careful here to figure out he's got the best words. But then I watched him. He wrote 6 words and then crossed out 3. You see, because he could still read the crossed out ones. So he was kind of, you know, stomping all over my system there. That was the letter of the law, however, you know. So, any case, the idea, though, is please don't make your children feel like they're being tested if they need to refresh their memory. Good. And then you can tell it back. And I will point out to you that just doing this, just the telling it back part, is extremely powerful. I have had dozens, if not hundreds now, of special ed teachers, parents with kids of reading issues, comprehension issues. The superintendent of public instruction for the state of Alaska put me on a team of worldwide reading experts to design a reading program for the state of Alaska, which included keyword outlines, because it's the most powerful thing you can do to improve comprehension. It actually changes the way you read. Have you ever noticed that kids can kind of just watch words go by and say they read something? Right? Say your kids, I read it. What did it say? I don't know. Did you read it? Yes, I did. Well, what did it say? I don't know. Did you actually read it? Yes, I did. I mean, go on like that forever. But when you have to read a sentence and stop and ask yourself a question, what are the key words in the sentence? That's reading in an entirely different way. It's called thinking. Really, because you have to ask yourself a question. You have to have an internal dialogue. Which word, what does this mean? Which words will carry this meaning here? So you may discover that just teaching this and just doing that will improve reading comprehension if you have children who struggle in that area. That's even before you get to the writing part, right? However, if I wanted to, I could have students now go ahead and write The Fox and the Goat. And I am sure that all of you could probably do that. If I said, take out a piece of paper and write the story of The Fox and the Goat, use these keywords to help you remember, everyone could do that, couldn't you? And no one would have the problem, I can't think of anything to write, and I could get about the business of teaching you how to do that writing better, you see? There would probably be 3 styles. One style is some people, for some odd sense of integrity, would feel compelled to make their Fox and the Goat as close to the original Fox and the Goat as possible. they would feel if they didn't do that, then they'd be bad or wrong or something. Another style, probably the men, we would try to do it in as few words as possible. We would just, you know, make whole sentences, but nothing else. Then there'd be a few of you who would look at this as an opportunity and say, wow, we could really get into this. And we could talk about how the fox, trying to show off for his friends, began doing pirouettes, which he had learned in ballet class on the edge of the well. But a strong gust of wind came by and he lost his balance. We'd end up with like 10 sentences just to get the fox in the well. Right? And that would be okay too. That would be fine. But nobody would have a problem. I don't know what to write about. Do you see? So just doing this will get you into the writing very quickly. And then we can talk a little bit about how to do that writing well. Now, one of the things that I think is so very important, especially if some of you are say, a bit new to homeschooling and you're feeling like, you know, you have to do everything the right way. First thing I will tell you is there is no right way to do most everything. There's lots of ways to do things. But one of the things I like to point out when you're asking children to write is that you, yourself, the teacher, the parent, should remember that writing is a very, very sophisticated and complex neurological activity. It is the hardest thing that human beings do. And it involves a lot of different brain functions, which have to kind of happen simultaneously. And in young children, that doesn't happen easily. For example, composition, spelling, and handwriting really are completely different things as far as the brain is concerned. They're so different, they don't even happen in the same part of the brain. And so you've got over here, you've got, composition. That's putting words into sentences that make sense and sentences into a logical sequence. Agreed? That has absolutely nothing to do with spelling or handwriting. Spelling, I'm going to give a whole lecture on it, I think, today. Yeah, so I'm going to do a whole hour on spelling in the brain. I will tell you, spelling has nothing whatsoever to do with language as far as the brain is concerned. And the brain function. Handwriting has nothing to do with either of those. Handwriting is completely different. What is it?
Art.
Art, yeah. It's see a pattern, copy the pattern, copy it closely and carefully, so much so that you can remove the original, reproduce the pattern. Do that with such repetition that you can do it automatically without thinking about it. It has nothing to do with language. So what I'm saying is, I'm not saying you shouldn't teach handwriting, you should obviously teach spelling. However, if what you want is good English composition, don't pester the child about spelling things correctly and writing neatly. Because if you do, you can split his brain. He'll do none of that well. The best analogy I can come up with is driving. Have you ever taught a teenager to drive? I do this every 3 years. All my children are 3 years apart, exactly. So every 3 years, I teach someone to drive. It's hilarious. When they first start, they're like, okay, there's this wheel, and there's these pedals. There's these mirrors, and I can do this and not kill us. And you are very grateful. They're using every erg of their attentiveness to not kill you. After you've been driving 10 years, what happened? You get in the car, you start driving, right? You can surf the radio, you can talk on the cell phone while if you're in California looking around for cops because you're not supposed to talk on the phone while you're driving. You can drink lattes, you can check your GPS, you can read the magazine at the stoplights. I'm not saying you should do all that. What I'm saying is you can do all that stuff and not even notice that you are driving. Right? You've automated or sublimated the activity. That's what happens with writing, but it can take years. So one of the things I recommend is you try to free the child up from having to feel like he needs to be neat on the paper. Because if he's trying to be neat, he won't be able to think. He won't be able to think very well about the words in the sentences because he'll have too much concentration on making a proper letter or making it look good or staying on the lines or whatever. I recommend that you actually use what I do, which is I make the rule in my class, no erasing allowed. I do not let children erase on the paper for a few reasons. Number one, it breaks that neatness very quickly. Number two is it allows them the freedom to make changes and it defeats that perfectionistic thing. Perfectionism is a very enemy of good writing because we want children to be willing to make changes to what they've done. And so I actually make no erasing allowed. And if I ever get a girl in my class, you can usually spot them, you know, right off. She will erase the two words so she can squeeze in the three that are supposed to be there so she won't have to copy it over. I just come over with my pen and I make a lot of changes and cross out and make a big mess on her paper so she knows there's no hope. There's no such thing as a first and only draft in my universe. It doesn't exist in my classes or my home. And if you're strict about this, no erasing, you always copy it over or type it out, then you don't have to argue about it. If you only do it sometimes, that's like sometimes you have to brush your teeth. And then you got to have an argument every night about whether you should or shouldn't. But if you always just do it that way, there's no argument. So from the very beginning, little kids, no erasing, always rewrite or type a second or third draft, you're in better shape. And I would recommend you even go so far as to do what I do. Actually, I recommend you always do what I do because that's the best way to do things. But I actually encourage the children to use pen, not pencil. The reason is manyfold. First of all, you can't erase a pen, so the temptation is gone, unless you have one of those ultimate heretical devices, the erasable pen, but you don't buy those. They're awful. So then you can't erase. By the way, have you noticed what a horrific waste of time it is to erase? It takes four times as long to erase a word as it takes to write one. Have you ever watched a child write a whole sentence, decide they don't like it, and then erase the entire sentence off the paper and brush all the droppings? It's just, you know, it's messy, it takes too much time, and it's a bad habit. So I recommend pen because you can't erase. But I also recommend pen for a few other reasons. Pencils are neurologically, tactilely, and emotionally disturbing. No, I'll prove it to you. Have you ever noticed that children have a compelling need to constantly sharpen their pencil? Now, you think it's because they want to get out of their chair and walk around and go to the pencil. It's not true. Give them a pen, they'll sit there for an hour. I've seen this again and again. The reason children sharpen pencils so much is because they're constantly changing. So when you start, it gives you one level of friction, one tactile kinesthetic experience. 2 minutes later, it's duller, and it's giving you a different feeling. 2 minutes, it's duller, and it's giving you a different feeling. And 2 minutes after that, it's so different than what you started from. Children crave one thing above all else. What is that? Consistency. They want the pencil to stay the same. Okay? Another reason pencils are bad is they contribute to tired hand disease. Do any of you have children who claim tired hand disease? All right. That is a neurological problem. 8 times out of 10, it is connected with a visual immaturity. You could maybe call them mildly dyslexic. Maybe they actually are dyslexic. You could all say they're just not cooked yet, right? They're just young children with immature visual pathways. But what happens is when you have a young child who is dyslexic or immature in the visual pathways, they like to see a clear, dark, contrasting line. This is why boys always like dark colors when they color. They'll use black, dark blue, purple. They see it better. And so what happens when you're writing with a pencil is pencils aren't black, they're gray. To make it darker, what do you have to do? Push harder, which not only contributes to tired hand disease, it causes you to break the tip of your pencil, and then you got to go sharpen the darn thing again. So if you're absolutely married to the ideas of pencils, you should use soft, thick, lead mechanical pencils, which are more consistent and will give a darker line more easily. But then you have to deal with the clicking and the lead falling all over the place and all that. Because I'm telling you, just dump the pencils and use a pen. And you know, because pens give you a nice dark line, you don't have to push harder, right? So you get a nice black pen, you get a nice dark line, you don't have to push any harder to get it. So you're not likely to get tired hand disease as often. So you know that thing we learned in school, rough draft in pencil, final in pen? It actually should be exactly the opposite for your kids. Rough draft in pen so they don't waste any time erasing, and final in pencil so when they're transcribing, they can make, if they make an error, copy a word wrong or leave something out, they can erase it and get a nice finished version. Because let's face it, if they make too many errors when they're transcribing from their messy copy to their final, and they had to recopy it, they won't. They'll scream bloody murder and run out of the room in horror. You wouldn't do it. It's just not worth it to recopy the thing a third time. Now, if you type the second one, then you can make some more changes. Go and spit out another copy from the type, you know, from the printer, and then you can get a third, even a fourth revision if you've typed the second one. I would recommend for almost all children that you do not have them compose at the keyboard, unless they're just so handicapped that there's no option. But there are a lot of good reasons to not compose at the keyboard, to start writing on paper and to keep writing on paper as long as possible. One of those is just practical. You get a homeschool kid who starts typing everything at 8 years old and never writes on paper anything except for math, and then he goes off to take the SAT, the ACT, the GED, the TOEFL, even the GRE exam. They all have handwritten on paper essays. So if you don't have a little bit of ability to write on paper, you're going to be a big disadvantage there. Go take a college class, being able to take notes. I personally know many professors who disallow laptops during lectures because it's just so distracting. So the ability to write on paper is not yet a non-existent need. It is still a very much of a need. In fact, it's even becoming more so as the shift back towards better literacy is moving people onto paper in a way. But if you have a child, you know, obviously if you had cerebral palsy or something, you couldn't hold a pencil, that would be a case where, you know, typing would be a necessity. But for most of your kids, I would recommend. Now, if you flip over the paper, you will notice that there's a little diagram of a messed up piece of paper. That's kind of the type of thing that I will show my students and say, you know, if your paper looks like this, I'll be happy, because I'll know that you are working hard to make it sound good when it's read, not spending a bunch of time trying to make it look nice, which is the least important thing to me. But there are a few things we want to encourage the child to do when they write the story or article. And so there are some things we call dress-up techniques you see there. And we make a little checklist for them. So having a little rubric or checklist is very helpful. And the dress-up makes sense to kids because style can change. And clothing is the most obvious way. You wear certain clothes, you know, to play in, jeans and t-shirt. You wear other clothes, you know, when you want to look silly or goofy if you're going to a costume party. You wear other clothes if you want to look more professional. So the idea that you can write differently, you can use different words to make ideas sound different. You could be jeans and t-shirt style in a note to your mom. You could be wild and crazy in a letter to your friend. And if you're trying to write professionally or stylishly, you might do certain things intentionally, like I put on a tie. So that makes a lot of sense to them. The first dress-up, which you see there, is actually not the first one I always teach first. The first one I always teach is really the L-Y word, which I mentioned in the last session. Most of these are adverbs. We're going to later point out to the child it's an adverb. But it's actually handier to start using them before you know what the thing is called, because then you know what the thing is called. When you find out what the thing is called, it has some meaning. Oh, that's what I do. Oh, that's an adverb. Rather than this thing, adverb, what's that? Never heard of it before. Do you see? So we first say L-Y words. And one of the things you can do is make a little list with the children, probably on a whiteboard. I will tell you, if you're trying to teach writing at home and you are not using a large, and when I say large, I'm talking at least, you know, 4 feet wide, a large whiteboard, if you are not, you're totally blowing it. If you're trying to do everything on paper, or worse, you have one of these little microscopic, you know, Safeway kind of whiteboards that you can just put a checklist. No, you need a nice big board. You know, go to Home Depot and get a big sheet of laminated Maronite, throw it up on the wall. You're not trying to do Martha Stewart homeschooling anyway, I hope. And just get yourself a nice big board. If you can afford the magnetic kind, cost you a couple hundred, lifetime investment, well worth every penny. But you can do it cheap, you can do it good, but you have to have a whiteboard if you're going to teach writing. And then you've got a place and you can make a list of words. Or you could do it on a nice big pad of paper, and you could put, then you could stick it on the wall and keep it there and use it for story. But you go through and say, okay, the fox fell into the well. How did he fall? He somethingly fell into the well. What words might work there? You're going to have to shout because I can't hear you too well. Clumsily.
Accidentally.
Frantically. He frantically tried to escape but could not get out. All right. The goat passed by and somethingly asked, "What are you doing?"
casually, incredulously. Ooh, I love it. Incredulously asked. The fox said, "There's a drought. There's going to be a drought, and I came down to get the water." The fox somethingly said, "There's going to be a horrible drought." Slyly, cunningly, emphatically. All right. Why don't you come down too? He somethingly suggested. Coyly. Ooh. Persuasively. All right. The goat somethingly thought that was a good idea and jumped down into the well. Foolishly. Ignorantly. Thoughtlessly. And then the fox somethingly jumped onto the horn's back and out. Triumphantly. Ooh. And somethingly said, "You should be careful of bad advice." Snidely. Is that right? Snidely, sarcastically. All right, so now when you get a couple dozen LY words that are kind of guaranteed to fit in the story, then when the child is writing the story, right, and he sees the checklist, have to have an LY word, okay. He looks on the list, right? One of the words hops off the list, right, into his eyes, through his brain, out the pencil, and I'm sorry, out the pen, and onto the paper, and he writes a word he would not have been able to think of, thereby sounding smarter than he actually is. Although, it's much better than that. That's a superficial effect. What really happens, if a word hops off the list through a brain and into a paper a few times, what's going to happen? He'll gain mastery of the word. He'll have ownership. He will become smarter than he previously was. Word lists are brain expanders. And so then if you have this on the whiteboard or transfer it better onto some poster paper, poster board, then you can stick it on the wall. And then next story, make another list of words that work in that story. Next story, make another word that work in that one. And then you've got lots of words that he is now getting familiar with. And then when you run out of wall space, you can alphabetize them, put them on a piece of paper, and he can keep it in a notebook or keep it handy. You see? So, word lists are brain expanders. The second technique, which is the first one on the list, is the who, which. And I won't try to do much teaching about that other than to say most literate native speakers of English do fine. You just tell them to do it and they start to see opportunities. And what's nice about telling them to do this along with some of the other techniques we have is it replaces other things. Have any of you got kids who write kind of like this? A fox was walking by, and then he fell into a well, and he could not escape. And then a goat came by, and then the goat said, "Why are you in the well?" And then the fox said, "And so, and then, and, and." You ever had kids write like that? Well, this whole process will reduce that. Number one, because we're coming from complete sentences, we're going into key words, and these are more likely to come into complete sentences and not be all strung together with and, and. Second thing is if you say do, a who, or which somewhere, then you're going to have to replace an and. So a goat passed by and asked, "What are you doing down there?" A goat who passed by asked, "What are you doing down there?" It forces a different, a little bit more sophisticated or more literary sounding grammatical construction. And then you see we also recommend the use of the word because. And that forces the children to add a bit more detail. It forces them to look causally into why something is the way it is. So they have to use that one. And then the last one is the strong verb. And for a strong verb, to teach that, you find a weak verb, some kind of weak, lame, lousy one. In Aesop fables, almost always, you can start and get rid of the word said. Right? So said is dead. Any replacement for it would be a strong verb. So The fox said there's going to be a drought. What could you use in place of that? He hinted. He shouted. He exclaimed. He whispered. The goat said, "Come on." The fox said, "Come on down."
Enticed.
I don't know if that would necessarily always work. Suggested. There's about 500 synonyms for the word said. So you can start building a list. You get it just like the LY word. And I will virtually guarantee you that if you take an Aesop fable or a little bit of interesting information, which is at or preferably below the reading level, show the child how to do a keyword outline. Just do it together the way I did with you, just like this. Maybe let him try the last couple sentences on his own if he's starting feeling like he's starting to get the hang of it. Tell back the story or article information a couple times verbally, right? And then let him write that out. And if looks good, help him brainstorm maybe one LY word. Start with one technique. Do that till it's easy. Add in another technique. Add in another technique and stretch it out over weeks or months according to how it becomes easy. I've never met a child who didn't respond positively to this approach, especially if they're the ones who have that blank page, I can't think of anything, I hate this, that frustration, which I can relate to so well. So that would be how you reach a reluctant writer. I will be back. I don't know if I'm in this room or a different room, but I will be teaching on spelling at 2:45. My company, Institute for Excellence in Writing, has a booth. It's in the main foyer area, so it's not in the big exhibition room. It's in the area outside the exhibition room. Stop by and see you. If you have a couple questions, you can grab me here, or I'll be over at that booth later. God bless you.